Hello, I'm Andrew Muller, and welcome to The Big Interview on Monocle 24. My guest today is one of the most influential graphic artists of our time, a writer and cartoonist who has radically altered and expanded the relationship between writing and cartooning. He is Art Spiegelman, who came up through the underground comic scene of the 1970s, working for magazines like Raw, and rose to international prominence in the 1980s with Mouse, a collection of cartoon strips, later a book, recalling his father's survival of the Holocaust, which won Spiegelman a Pulitzer Prize. In forums, including the front cover of The New Yorker, Spiegelman has continued to bring a cartoonist's whim and wit to bear on the most serious of issues, the more so since controversies from Yolande Posten to Charlie Hebdo put him and his fellow practitioners on the front line of the battle between free expression and theocratic fanaticism. Art Spiegelman joins me in the studio here at Midori House in London. Art Spiegelman, welcome to The Big Interview.
Oh, thanks for having me, Andy.
We should acknowledge up front that we are recording this on the Wednesday after the Tuesday. So we have now had, I guess, a few hours to come to terms with the idea, or to come to terms with the idea of saying out loud the phrase President-elect Donald Trump.
Well, don't do it out loud yet. It's too soon.
But I did want to ask you, were, say, for example, The New Yorker or any other publication to come to you right now, and indeed maybe they already have, to ask you to furnish some sort of illustration, where would you even begin?
Well, first of all, I'd start drawing it in Canada and then figure out how to not draw people coming to Canada, which is what every other cartoonist is probably at their board working on right now. But I don't know. I mean, it's my wife's problem. She's the art editor of The New Yorker, and she has to find something in the next 48 hours where everybody was prepared to figure, how do you draw a Hillary 1 cover that's not totally boring? Now it's how to find a way to draw the unthinkable and make it visible.
That image you cite, though, of a sort of massive exodus over the border to Canada, which I'm sure is an image that will pop into a lot of people's head, mm-hmm. and it's a joke that is already doing the rounds on social right. media. When you're preparing to write something illustrating, trying to focus into one image, something that everybody's thinking about and everybody's talking about, how do you take steps to guard against, I guess, doing the obvious thing, the thing that everybody else will be doing?
Well, by doing them as part of the process of finding something nobody's done yet. And for me, I've never thought of myself as a political cartoonist, even though I've made cartoons deal with political subjects.
If you were thinking about the idea of, and I'll brace you for it this time, President-elect Donald Trump, which does still seem a completely preposterous thought at so many levels, where would you start? Because, again, there's such a strong visual identity with him mm-hmm. that cartoonists have made all sorts of hay with.
Mm-hmm. Called his hair, right?
His hay. Hair, making hay his hair. There is an analogy there, in fact. But do you fall back into that? Do you try and...
I've tried to avoid making these pictures this round, because from the very beginning I found it suspect in that, you see, Trump won because of my pals in the media. This really should have been dealt with more harshly than as a great kind of extension of whatever, Saturday Night Live, so that it just became diverting and entertaining for a short time. But I had the good fortune of being so allergic to his face, like from the very beginning. It's just like, I want to punch that man, and if I do, I'm going to have to buy a new TV set. And the problem there is anything I did that would be even amusing on any level would also promote this bastard, and he knows that. He knows that even though he'll threaten to kill, jail, or sue, probably sue anybody who says something unkind about him or accurate in other vocabulary, he knows that that actually is what his fuel is. That's what makes it all work. And man, did he sucker punch everybody I know who's a journalist or a pundit or a thinker.
I guess to bring it back to your own work, when something this peculiar happens, which even by the standards of 2016, which has been a pretty vintage year, does it cause you to doubt the value of satire?
Yes. I don't want to make people just laugh at Trump. I mean, the image that would come to mind for me is like a sleeve with a hand on the nuclear button, and the hand is about 1/8 the size of what it should be. And then, yuck, 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 we're all going to get blown up. But that's not where I would want to go. I mean, for me, actually, Trump has a lot in common with Brexit. I'm sure people have been punditing on that all
Indeed.
Day, too. It's really part of a current zeitgeist that's very, very ugly. I don't always use Hitler as a glib analogy. It has to be pretty critical. But I think we're entering into a period where the fascist boot of America has been shined. It's back and visible for walking. And that's really a horrible thing because it's always been one strain of American culture. And he's legitimized it. So that's one thing. And on the other hand, what we're living with, you'll soon be living with Trump, because being president of America is, in some weird way, being president of the Western world or
Indeed.
Something. But the other way you're living with it is the Brexit thing. The Brexit thing, nobody really believes it would be more than just a joke. So now we've got something that's more than a joke, but people wish they could walk it back. I'm sure in America, there'll be a lot of people wanting to walk it back once they see what Trump is like if they didn't know.
I did want to ask you about an essay you wrote about 10 years ago in Harper's, which I was revisiting while I was thinking about what we're going to talk about. It was the Drawing Blood one, which I'm sure you remember.
Sure.
And it was just one of those pieces I read that stuck completely in my head for a lot of reasons,
because
it was articulating a lot of things I was trying to figure out myself at the time. But one of the lines in it that stuck was when you wrote, and I'm reading your own words back to you, you said, "I'm not at all religious, but I am a devout coward." Now, that's a nice line, but is that somewhat ingenuous? Because especially now, and especially in what we've seen in the last decade, from the Gillen's Post and cartoon brouhaha via Charlie Hebdo to where we are now, isn't any cartoon kind of an act of bravery?
Well, I mean, it might be giving it too much credit, but I certainly think that the Charlie Hebdo cartoons who stuck it out after the slaughter are brave to keep doing this. Even if it's wrongheaded, it's brave. But do I think all cartoons are? No. There's some cartoons that are, I think, currying up to power and favor already, changing their caricature of Trump to look noble. I'm a coward, but I also do what I do. So what I do is I make cartoons. I mean, I need to do that just to find out what I'm thinking. Would I continue to draw pictures of Mohammed after, like, my comrades were all slain? I'm not positive I would, because the point was already made, which is something I think even some of the Charlie Hebdo cartoons have come to since. And I had never had any interest in drawing a picture of Mohammed until I was told I couldn't do it. You know, that's the cartooning impulse.
But when you think to situations like the Charlie Hebdo massacre, having been a cartoonist for as long as you have, or traded in that medium in various forms for as long as you have, are you still surprised by the anger and the fury that a few lines on a page can cause?
Well, I'm proud of it. Even though it's not the only purpose I work. It's not like trying to say, what will get everybody just get their pants in a knot? That's not the
point
of it.
If you thought like that, you could be president.
Yes, he'd make a much better cartoonist. Like, let's take him out of office, move him across the street to his hotel out of Pennsylvania Avenue and take it from there. Now, the thing is that it's the power of cartoon drawing. It's what kept me, and now as an adult, I can rationalize it. As a kid, I just was awed by the power. And what the power is to make an image that once seen can't be unseen. And that's really a great and powerful thing, because it enters into your brain the way your brain thinks. Like, the sad truth is we do not think in complex hologram-like images. We think in emoticons. And as a result, it makes sense that emoticons have entered into our vocabulary, let's say. It's because it makes something vivid quickly. Even a child can presumably understand it.
And that's why we can all remember Peanuts cartoons we read when
absolutely.
We were five.
Yeah, absolutely. We think in little bursts of language and strong images, like high-definition images. Those images need to be understood and dealt with, not suppressed, because A, they can't be once they're done, and killing the people who made them or muzzling them before they make them is battling away something that needs to be digested, otherwise it wouldn't be a source of trauma, the image itself a source of trauma. In other words, it's a good diagnostic tool for where the problems are. Like, certain things that would have been shocking in the 1950s no longer shock. It's just part of everyday imagery. The fact that anything that even pretends to make a gesture toward referring to, say, those Mohammed cartoons in a visual way is like off limits in a way that you can draw Jesus Christ doing the most deviant sex acts. You can do that and nobody will blink anymore. But the fact that this happens can be done for two reasons. One is genuinely to try to punish innocent people. That really stinks. That's, I think, I may be wrong, but that's how I understood the Gillen Post and action. The Danish cartoons were made in a relatively right-wing paper to discomfit the immigrant community. But if you look at the actual cartoons, which you couldn't because everybody was a coward then too, you'd find that there were 12 cartoons with very different points of view, some of which were supportive of the community and didn't draw a picture of Mohammed the Prophet, but drew a picture of this kid Mohammed who was going to school in a suburban place where this was proof that they wanted a picture of him was a proof of the racism of the newspaper. That was one of the 12 cartoons that was published. So what I did back in that magazine was I gave it a 1-4 fatwa rating on each cartoon and from the point of view of a secular cartoonist. And some of them were genuinely hateful. Some of them were actually accurate images. If you didn't have a label, the guy wearing a bomb, which is the only one you got to see because it was the most cogent of the cartoons in making its point, if you didn't make it Mohammed but just call it an imam, a radical, whatever you wanted to call it, that image conjures up that particular situation in a way that actually is something you can't unsee if you saw it. It's like that turban turning into a bomb. And that was a useful image to talk about. So were some of the others. And similarly, we're now in a situation where one can also do it for a good reason. It was Charlie Hebdo's mandate to do that cartoon, because after it was censored, all of the Eulenposten cartoons were not shown in France. It was their job to show them because they're a magazine whose subtitle is The Nasty and Stupid Magazine, Charlie Weekly. So it was their job to be nasty and in quotation stupid, to show the unshowable, to say the unsayable, because of an idealistic belief that that's their mission. At that time, I know it wasn't done to bait the Muslim community, just to say, you can't tell us what to draw. We're sorry, we're a secular society, and you cannot look at it. We can discuss what it means to show it, but we're an equal opportunity offender, and that's that. That's certainly not how it played out, and as a result, every time they were told not to do it, they would go further because that was their core set of convictions. So I don't think the way to deal with it is to avoid discussion. I think to have the discussion as civilly as possible while insisting that there are certain things that are that have to be acceptable.
I want to go back to that thing you were saying about the power of the image and about how you come to an understanding that human beings tend to think and remember in fairly brief blurts or emoticons, as you called them. Was that the jumping off point from deciding to confront, as you did in Mouse, the Holocaust by drawing cartoons, that you would take on the great trauma of the 20th century in what, to some people, I'm sure would have seemed an unlikely medium?
Well, you know, I'm too stupid to have thought that out in advance. In retrospect, it looks like that's exactly what I did. But this actually came from a much more out of touch with my feelings source. At the time that I started on what eventually became Mouse, the death camps were not part of our general collegial conversational knowledge. In other words, when I was researching what became that first 3-page strip about my father and me talk when I was a very little kid for an underground comic book that had a Robert Crumb sex story in front of it and fit right in with that somehow, well, all I was doing was trying to like deal with a subject that hadn't been dealt with. So it felt like this is matter that should be.
This is a thing that gets forgotten because relatively contemporary histories of World War II, those published in the decades immediately afterwards, often barely mention the Holocaust.
Winston Churchill.
I was just going to mention exactly that example. Churchill's own compendious history of World War II, which he famously wrote saying he knows history will treat him kindly because he intended to write it himself, but barely mentions them, even in passing.
Two sentences about Jews and then mixing them together with other groups who were treated differently than the Jews in World War II. But what we're living through now is like every year there's a best, I think there's a special Academy Award for the Holocaust, right?
So give them time.
Well, they certainly give the award every year, and some of these things are obscene to me. They're like hollow kitsch more than anything else. But here it's a different situation. So all I wanted was, I did this 3-page strip just out of the impulse of I needed to do it without knowing why. And the why was, it was underlying all of the out of control seething things in my head that I'd never kind of poked at and looked at. That's not what I thought I was doing when I did this thing. In fact, around the time I did Mouse, I did a strip that I can't even describe on the air because even I would blush and kick me out. but I tried to draw the most obscene thing I could think of, violent and obscene. It was the nature of underground comics to be transgressive that way. So I did, and I can only say it was so obscene that Robert Crumb's wife would never let me in the house after that.
And you would think she has a fairly high bar for this kind of
thing. I would think,
yeah.
I mean, S. Clay Wilson was a regular visitor for Captain Piscums and the Pervert Pirates. But I was banned because of that strip. And eventually, it took a while, I realized I was looking for atrocity in all the wrong places. Yeah, like that, there's atrocity much closer to my own life than this made-up, creepy image that if it's unforgettable, it should never have been shown to anybody in the first place. It was stupid. After we're off the air, I can tell you and other people can spend the next 2 months trying to figure out what is he talking about?
I shall hold you to that.
Because we always want to know what we're not supposed to know. That's why I had to draw Mohammed, as even if it was just as a stick figure, to show a feeble gesture that things must be showable and shown if they can be. Nevertheless, all that aside, when I returned to this in 1978 and turned Mouse into a long book, the drawing style was much more cooled down. I had to find a way to draw the long story of my relationship with my father and his relationship to history. But in the course of it, yes, I did use the mouse and cat masks for their relative blankness so that you can impose the individual faces. And that's more immersive than trying to draw portraits of people I never met. And the whole thing grew out of that. But it did grow out of having an ambition. And it wasn't to make the world a kinder place. I don't think it could. But what I was trying to do is make a very long comic book that needed a bookmark and asked to be reread. Not as good a marketing term as graphic novel, although I still find that phrase makes me shudder a little bit. But a very long comic book that needs a bookmark and asks to be reread is exactly what I was trying to make. I wasn't ashamed of comics, but I thought what wants to happen is the subject matter should be able to move beyond the puerile as well as embrace the puerile.
How important was it for you in Mouse? Because it was one of the many things that struck me about it was it's fiercely unsentimental in a way that a lot of those films you were just referring to are obviously not. And it's quite explicitly dismissive, I think, of the very common idea that suffering is somehow ennobling.
Absolutely. That's a Christian idea. It's because they think of like Christ dying for sins. And that's very uncomfortable.
Indeed, so.
Being nailed 2x4s and whatever. But in any case, yes, I mean, it's suffering doesn't do anything except cause pain. And then some people actually do come out ennobled. Some people come out worse than they ever were before. And some people just come out so crippled that they never really come out of it at all. So that was a true thing. And then trying to find a voice that wouldn't make me cringe, that wouldn't make me just feel that this was like exploiting what happened to my family, and just present it without either being a wise ass or too pious about it, but like just let it breathe, seemed like a good idea. In fact, I just read an interview with Paul Beatty, who got your Man Booker Prize.
Indeed so, yes.
And he was saying that when he was teaching a course in satire, he made everybody in his class read Mouse. But his question was, so each of you, could you name the funniest things that are in that book? And this is part of his own rant against being ghettoed off into satire rather than letting satire be an aspect of how one presents. And similarly, in Mouse, I think there, one could single out things that are genuinely funny, but they're not at the expense of people, except maybe like the foibles of my father in a sitcom way from now and again, or a funny story my father tells of what happened in the ghetto. And it was the kind of mordant humor that was being used in the ghetto, so it had a place in the deposition, let's say, of Mouse. But it wasn't about like what the book became, which is now it's become a kind of Auschwitz 101 for school kids. And
Are you comfortable with that? Because I was going to ask.
I'm never comfortable. Haven't you noticed that yet?
But I was going to ask if you've entirely reconciled in your head or understood or absorbed the effect that Mouse had on people.
I'm now, it takes me a long time. When I say I'm never comfortable, I am, but it takes about 10 years to say, wow, that was really a great experience. After it's been around for 10 years, I can kind of acknowledge it in my head and absorb it as, I had fun that day, you know, as somebody who has a predisposition toward anhedonia of some kind or another. Like, it just takes a while for me to catch up with what I'm actually feeling, thinking, and seeing. And when people come up to me and said it's the most important book in their lives, they were inspired by my work and they've made work as a result of that. It's a very important book. It's just, I just didn't think in those grandiose terms. I thought it was interesting almost despite its subject matter. The idea of doing a very long book that needs a bookmark, et cetera, and so on, seemed to me in and of itself interesting. And I had a few ideas, and I pursued this one because I was moving back to New York, would have to be in touch with my father anyway now that I'd come from San Francisco, and spent 6 months using a stunt I had learned in Dick Tracy's Crime Stoppers panel in the upper right-hand corner of putting a towel over the receiver so it sounds like a long-distance call, which was true at the time, and pretending I was still in San Francisco. I figured I'd have to come to terms eventually, and one way to do it was to actually have a reason to visit him other than just the pro forma reason. So we began interviews that lasted for the rest of his life.
I mean, on that subject of returning to New York, that leads us, I guess, inevitably to In the Shadow of No Towers, which was your response to September 11th. Do you perceive that as a companion volume to Mouse, I guess, without wishing to draw any equivalence between the scale of the disasters they
It has something
on.
To do with it, and it's like I was affected by both, and I agree with you about the scale, and there's some point where I talk about how the air in Lower Manhattan smelled like what my father was trying to describe when he described the burning bodies there. But that being said, I was intentionally making it a stupid comparison as I'm smoking cigarette after cigarette on those four panels to make the air smell even worse on that comics page. But the thing that really is true is that probably I was sensitized by having made Mouse, by having the parents who were hit by that, to realize I'm actually living in a fraught moment that has a great charge, just like we're doing today. And the reverb from it will be felt for a long time. And that made me have to relive September 11th and understand what I saw from being living just right next to Ground Zero, going down into it, get my daughter out of the high school that was across the street from the towers then, and make it subject matter. But it's not related to Mouse in the sense that stylistically, In the Shadow of No Towers is not a logical jump from the visual and even rhythm and approach of Mouse. It's much more disconnected because it was really, all I was trying to do is do a slow motion diary, because it takes me a long time to make my pictures, of what it felt like to be around after September 11th and see a tragedy turned into a war recruiting poster. So even though, like I mentioned before, I don't want to become a political cartoonist. It seems like you're then in the business of making something with a shelf life shorter than yogurt, but it still is used to decorate history books eventually to make things like the Teapot Dome scandal more understandable to kids who are stuck studying it there. And yet, that feeling of anxiety and fragmentation that did come through is what I hoped would come through. It's a book with a lot more gaps. It's like flashes of things and all juxtaposed together, doing comics in a much less acquiescent way than I did Mouse. Mouse was the result of these experimental comics that dealt with comics as time turned into space, if I had to say it in a short form. But then when I realized people want their stories, I want my stories too. So you have to give them a story. And that's actually what led to Mouse. It's not what led to the No Towers book. That really had to do with trying to deal with the fragmentation of experience and trying to make sense of stuff that doesn't feel like it makes sense.
When you're drawing especially cartoons reflecting on current or historical events, especially at this point, are you always entirely confident in your judgment? By which I guess I'm asking...
I'm confident that I'm almost always wrong.
Preempting the rest of my question, I was going to ask you, how often do you pick up the finished product and sort of go, not sure about that?
Oh, it happens often, and sometimes I've made mistakes. I did change that DNA of The New Yorker to allow for these things to happen, and I got basically seduced by Tina to publishing a cover I couldn't really defend. It was just an image that made me laugh of a crucified Easter bunny. But although one is allowed to make fun of one's own people, because then it's self-effacing and it's very classy to be masochistic that way. But if you make fun of other people, it's seen as arrogant. And as a result, that image was seen as Catholic bashing. But sometimes I've caught things and gotten them really right. And in those days, the idea of doing a cover about current events was antithetical to what The New Yorker was trying to do for the last 40 years before, or 50 years before I got there. It was kind of a happening magazine in the 20s and even into the 30s. But by the time it got to the 50s and beyond under its second editor, William Shawn, he was interested in making a bucolic and restful spot for the eye in a world of hurly-burly. So even even the issue that had the two-part article about Hiroshima by John Hersey, that was significant, and he trusted that that was words, and it was words about an important subject, and they were giving it their all by giving it two whole issues and cutting everything else out. But the cover was a very sweet Connecticut scene. And that wasn't either Tina's predisposition or mine. So it led to a kind of cover that's still now part of the New Yorker's way of approaching what it should be doing on the covers. I'm proud of that. I did one cover that I really liked, which was well before Columbine, in 1993. I'm not now remembering when Columbine happened, but
around then.
But this was well before that. There was a cover called The Guns of September, and it was kids getting off a school bus, little kids, and each of them had their Uzis and automatic weapons the way other kids in other situations carry their new lunchboxes to school. It looked like a children's book illustration, very benign. And that one I genuinely was proud of because I knew I'd caught something and I'd caught it before other people were discussing it even. It took something of the scale of Columbine to make it a public conversation.
To ask the same question from the other way around then, especially now and especially when the technology exists to lift an image out of whatever context it may have been created in and then whipped around the world and placed in other contexts in front of audiences who might be less receptive, do you ever find your hand staying, as it were, because you just find yourself thinking, I can't be bothered dealing with what follows from this?
Well, it makes the images have to withstand more scrutiny than one might have to do if you're just preaching to an audience whose mindset you understand. But it can be very, very powerful if you do it right. So there is a temptation. On the other hand, what I can't handle is rejection. And when you do covers, you have to like offer it up to somebody. You have to submit it. And I'm not good at submitting. So at a certain point, the process became difficult for me of just trying images out. And like there's somehow a mission accomplished by seeing other artists move in this direction and do images that could take advantage of the really powerful forum, specifically of the New Yorker cover, one of the last magazines that has covers that don't relate to inside stories but are sometimes very potent statements. And the one that comes to mind, I'm sure, is in your mind as well, which was Obama and Michelle in the White House when everybody was scared of them, and he's wearing a turban and they're doing a terrorist fist bump.
But was that image created to be misconstrued?
No, this was meant to catch the actual situation in a way that would be hard to do in words. And I can prove that it worked, even though now we were in the internet age. I made as much mischief as possible before images were scattered within 12 seconds and then had shaming posses after them in 20 seconds. That image was responding to the fact that not just Fox News, but the entire major media was talking about Madras schooling, terrorist fist bumps.
I remember the terrorist fist bump. That was a glorious moment.
Yeah, and like, you know, it relates well to the Freedom Fries moment that we lived through in 2001, right? But here, with this particular image, the entire mass media was guilty of trying to paint him as the other. That was reprehensible. Being able to show what everybody was trying to smear him with in one image made it all seem more absurd than deadly, even though it led, because it was a slow news week, to a two-week national referendum on satire. Like, it was all over the media as the cover being discussed as, was this going too far? Did you blah, 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 and insult the presidential candidate at that time? And my response was that they hadn't, that they had given Obama a very necessary inoculation. The same way you have to give somebody a little bit of a virus in order to protect them from a larger attack. By having this cover, which was attacking the attackers, I'll come back to that in a moment, attacking the attackers, all of a sudden it was okay to acknowledge that he's black, but he's not a terrorist Muslim. He's just black. He's a black man, and nobody was willing to even say that. But nevertheless, that was not part of the discourse because nobody wanted to offend. So what happened as a result of this crazy, endless dialogue about this image before it died down was the proof that this worked was in the letters condemning the cover. They'd say, well, I'm a New Yorker reader. I'm sophisticated. I understood this cover. But what about those jerks out there, the ones who just like changed our world?
I'm taking offense on behalf of others.
Right, because they won't know the context, and they'll just, you know, and this is basically describing the great middle that I just had to meet up with in Texas and scared me, the ones who took over the planet just now. So, but at that time, there wasn't a single pirate T-shirt of that cover worn by Make America Great Again Yahoo type of American, because they knew that this was making fun of what they believed in. In other words, all of these covers usually do get appropriated as little badges, as postcards, as magnets. I was very proud of a couple of others that were used that way back in the day. But the fact that it never became an image appropriated by the people who indeed saw him as like an alien creature Obama, they couldn't use it. All it did was say, I'm an idiot on a T-shirt.
a perfect note on which to end. Art Spiegelman, thank you very much for joining us.
This was a pleasure, Andrew. Thank you.
You've been listening to The Big Interview with me, Andrew Muller, in conversation with Art Spiegelman. The Big Interview is produced by Bill Luty and Gaia Lutz and edited by Claire Crofton. Until next time, all that's left to say is goodbye, and thank you very much for listening.